From WXXI News, this is Connections, and I'm Daniel Kushner. Our connection this hour comes from a favorite song of mine from 2012. On the fourth track of the album Fear Fun, Josh Tillman, a.k.a. Father John Misty, incisively critiques would-be authors with one devastating line. "I'm writing a novel because it's never been done before." As someone currently in the beginning stages of writing my own novel, that hits home and cuts deep. But the point is well taken. A lot of people aspire to write an ambitious piece of fiction that will be read voraciously by fans and adored by critics. But what does it really take to fashion a narrative idea into a cohesive long-form story that can then captivate readers for 200-plus pages or so? To begin to answer that question, I'm joined by two local writers who know firsthand what it means to start and finish writing a book. I'd like to introduce our first guest. We have Kristen Felicetti, the author of Log Off, published earlier this year in June. Log Off is a novel that follows a teenage girl as she establishes an online presence in the immediate aftermath of Y2K hysteria. Felicetti also has a Substack, similarly called Log Off, and she was the founding editor-in-chief of the literary magazine The Bushwick Review. Kristen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Our second guest is Charlie DeMott Wildy, whose dystopian novel Lightning Bolt depicts a convenience store clerk and aspiring writer navigating a post-apocalyptic city formerly known as New York. Before publishing Lightning Bolt last year, Wildy first made a name for himself in the Rochester scene as a member of the comedy collective Goo House in the 2010s and continues to be an active member of the local comedy scene. Charlie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Cool. So we've set the stage. I'm anticipating a detailed yet free-ranging conversation about writing, publishing, and promoting one's own novel. I want to start, though, by asking you both, was there a particular cathartic moment of inspiration for each of these books, or was it more of a slow burn?
Well, I started writing short stories in this kind of setting vaguely, even back when I was still in college. So I had written a number of short stories, none of which are published, and probably none of which are quite good enough to need to be published anyhow. But it was kind of a milieu that I had been thinking about and sort of mulling over. And I had started outlining a few ideas that eventually I sort of settled on something that was like, okay, this will work. This is a book-length idea that I can kind of explore. And so in that sense, it sort of came gradually. I think I had been mulling over some of the sort of themes that I wanted to explore, and eventually it kind of calcified into something a little more solid to really get started working on.
That makes sense to me. Do you remember like an early moment where you started conceiving of the main character or the setting in general, or was it just by a certain point it was just gestating and just
I think that that's probably the best way to think of it. Yeah, the setting itself being this kind of, I always sort of describe it as a boring apocalypse. It's this kind of like post-apocalyptic world that nobody really knows that the world has ended. That was an idea that I had heard kind of, and I should have this front of mind, but I heard a different writer kind of talk about the idea of like, what if the world already ended and we just didn't notice, and I kind of fixated on that idea, and I wanted to sort of push it and exaggerate it into a sort of science fiction thing. And then as far as like this specific main character who carries this book, and it really started with the ideas I wanted to explore before it settled on there being a character. And you know, there were people I knew that this character was kind of based on, and as it developed, got further and further away from those original inspirations. But I still kind of had these sort of, you know, there was some small sparks that eventually just kind of led to it a little bit more.
Yeah. Got it. And Kristen, for you?
Yeah, I started working on this novel pretty seriously around like 2018, 2019. And I think at that point I'd had kind of some of the ideas about like Alora, the main character, like some of her offline life. But then I had kind of been thinking about LiveJournal, which is this like early blogging platform, and kind of how that differed from the internet of today, and feeling kind of a bit nostalgic for it. And so that's when I got the idea to kind of do the book in that like LiveJournal format. It's told entirely in that format. And once I had that idea, then everything else kind of came together like really quickly. And like kind of the full story and there, and that's kind of was that moment for me. But yeah, like Charlie, I started doing like short pieces and short fiction pieces before like tackling a full novel.
Got it. I will say one of the things I really love about the format that you chose for Log Off is that because of the structure of a LiveJournal post, it has a built-in music soundtrack. So at every point, the reader with I'm pretty sure like with every entry, every sort of mini chapter, if you will, there is a song associated with it that people can listen to on their own time or as they're reading perhaps. And it was definitely like delightful to like see Ben Folds Five's debut album, like well represented, like just sort of little stuff like that. I had a similar like moment of delight in reading your book, Charlie, when it suggested that the characters meet at a bar called Tap and Mallet.
R.I.P. Tap and Mallet.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was just sure. It was a place that I, you know, and like you said, it. The setting is really supposed to be New York City, and in general, I based it all like very geographically. And I lived in New York City right before I had started working on this, and so I was basing it a lot off of my neighborhoods or the places I'd hang out or the places where my friends lived.
Yeah.
But Tap and Mallet was just a place that me and my friends would hang out at here in Rochester all the time, and it felt like the right setting for a scene I had in mind.
Yeah.
And when I wrote it, it still existed, and now it lives on forever in Lightning Bolt. We can still visit Tap and Mallet in our hearts.
Yes. My wife worked there. I don't think I ever met her during that time,
yeah.
but for sure. No, that place, I think is a touchstone for a lot of people here in Rochester. How long did you know, in working on the ideas that would eventually become your novels, how long did it take for you to know that it was going to be a larger scale work and perhaps not one of the short stories that you had worked on previously?
I think I always like originally knew once I started that it was going to be a novel. I never kind of envisioned it as like a short story, but kind of figuring out how to construct a novel. And, you know, like I think I kind of wrote it like a short story in the beginning where I would just like write bits that like felt exciting to me, and then I was kind of like, okay, I actually have to like order this out and finish this through from beginning to end, and then like the editing process and such. So yeah, I always kind of knew it was going to be a novel.
Mm-hmm.
It was really just a decision that was made due to life circumstances. I started writing this shortly after having my daughter, and we had just moved from New York City to the Ithaca area. And so my time and energy for creative projects kind of changed. My relationship to my own creativity had to change just because of being in a new life situation. And so it really was a thing where I wanted to have a project to be working on, partially out of vanity, so that if somebody asked me, hey, what are you working on? I always had in my back pocket, like, well, I'm working on this book. You know, for years I had a good answer for what are you working on. But it also was whenever I had those little moments where it's like, okay, well, here's a free evening, here's a little bit of an afternoon, here's something. I had one specific project that I was already pretty focused on. I had been working to get it all outlined. I knew a lot about where I wanted it to go. So if I had at any given moment 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours to sit down and work on it, I didn't have to sit there and think, oh, what am I going to work on today? I had the one. I knew that it was just going to be like, if I do this one book, It'll give me something to be working on, and then once it's done, then we'll figure out whatever the next steps are after that.
Is it difficult to avoid, if the desire is to avoid it, is it difficult to avoid making the work autobiographical?
I don't know that I avoid making it autobiographical.
That's fair too. Yeah, I'm just curious.
I think that it is, in ways, explicitly autobiographical. I think that I used it as a place to put all my insecurities, and so I think that that was kind of explicitly part of the point. I think it may be a little bit of a flaw that there isn't as much. I always wonder what it would be like for most of the people I've talked to who've read it know me. And so I wonder, like, what would it be like to read this book for people who haven't also spent a bunch of time around me? Is there any character in the book at all, or it only works for the people who know me personally because they get to fill in all the blanks because they know who I am? So I think it's definitely autobiographical, maybe to a fault, but certainly that was not a mistake. It's that I'm in there sort of on purpose.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't really lean away from that either. I mean, like, probably one of the most common questions I've gotten about the book is, like, how much of this is based on your real life? And I get it, because I have that question when I read stuff, too. But, yeah, I mean, I think I'm pretty honest about that, like, where it's, like, you know, it's kind of, like, emotionally true, if not, like, necessarily all facts and details true. And, you know, the character has, like, a lot of similarities to me and, like, my life. And, you know, I took inspirations from, like, some of my friends that I grew up with as teenagers, and I wanted to be honest about that too. I didn't want to, you know, I knew they were going to read the book and didn't want to be like, oh, it's all made up or something. So yeah, I feel like it was a lot of, like, experiences they're same, but, like, the actual construction of the story is, like, all fictional. Like, specifics, there's almost no specific scene that, like, actually happened to me, but a lot of the experiences align with mine or some of my friends.
And the town that it's set in is a fictional version of Penfield, right?
Yes. So there's that aspect too, where I grew up in Penfield, and so the suburb called Parkview in the book is kind of like a fictional Penfield, or, like, east side of Rochester suburb, and that was really fun too. It's deliberately fictionalized in the book, because, like, it's written on the internet, like, during, like, Y2K, and I think during that age, people had a lot of worries about, like, stranger danger and not wanting to know who you really were online. So, but there's a lot of recognizable Rochester things that have, like, different names, like, you know, like Wegmans and Bill Gray's and things like mm-hmm. that.
A colleague of mine here at WXXI News, Jeremy Moll, wants to know how you keep your characters' backstories straight.
I don't know. I have, like, such a bad memory for, like, anything that just, like, literally happened yesterday. But for some reason, that I can keep, like, memorized completely. Like, I just, like, feel within that I know the characters' backstories and even sort of things about, like, dates and things. Sometimes I'll write a doc or something to keep it straight. But for the most part, I can. It's one of the weird things that I can remember very well.
I think for me, it was mostly that the character sort of develops organically as it goes. I have the kind of most of the characters really more than they're supposed to be people. They rarely just represent different ideas or relationships to the themes of the book. So by interacting with the different characters, we're interacting with the different themes. And so for the main character's backstory, that stuff was pretty unimportant to me early on, and it became apparent as I was writing this, like, well, I really should have a little bit figured out, and it just kind of organically developed as to, like, well, how did this guy end up here? And so those questions just kind of answered themselves as they went, and it was really just a matter of keeping on track with whatever developed as it went.
Yeah, I think the idea that, like, you're communicating the emotional truth of what you want to say based on your experience and your observations, while also sort of making sure that you touch on some themes. And so the scenarios and characters are built around the themes. That makes a lot of sense to me. It feels like a patchwork way to, and I don't say that in a derogatory way, it feels like kind of a patchwork approach to writing a novel, but it feels like that's like a feasible way to do it in such a fashion that doesn't feel overwhelming, you know, otherwise. What did your daily work routines look like? I imagine that a creative undertaking like this requires a lot of discipline, and consistently so.
I think, like, for this novel in particular, I have a day job now that's pretty much Monday through Wednesday, 9 to 5. I did when I wrote this novel as well. So I think pretty much just like writing things in like nights and weekends and editing it as well. But I agree. I think you have to be like really structured about your time. Like, you know, when I was writing the book 5 years ago, I was able to like just do like all-nighters and be, or not all-nighters, but stay up really late and stay up till 1 a.m. But now I'm kind of in a different place, so I kind of structure things around like my mornings before work.
It's definitely something that I struggle with and could stand to be a bit more disciplined. I think that I find that I would write when I was drawn to write, and I had to kind of trust that the creative drive would be there enough to see me through to the end. It gave me a thing creatively to be working on, and I needed the outlet one way or the other. I needed to have something there to do with that creative energy, and so this just got to be the thing where it was. So I don't know that I can say I had the discipline necessarily to write it, or you know, to stick to anything structurally. It just was, if I've got the energy and the focus to do it, I will make sure that I am sitting down to do it. And there are times when maybe I feel frustrated if I have some creative drive or creative energy, but logistically I'm not in an opportunity where I could sit down and be productive creatively. And that just is part of the process too. To be honest, I have spent, you know, if it's like, you know, I've got a day job, regular kind of hours, and sometimes it's like, well, it's 3:30 or 4. I've got a little bit of time before I can technically clock out, but I've done everything I need to do today. So I'll just like pull up the Google Doc and plug away at it a little bit. Like, it, you know, I kept it in one kind of place. So it's like, no matter if I'm on a work computer, if I come up with an idea and I want to pull it up on my phone, I think it's obviously best if you can, you know, you'll be at your most productive if you can get into a good rhythm with writing. Like, obviously, like sitting down to write for 10 or 15 minutes can only get you so far. So if you can give yourself the time to really spin the engine up. But for me, it was just like when the drive was there, I had to do my best to just like really, you know, get down in a, you know, get in a chair and get my hand on a keyboard and get it going. But it was tricky. You know, discipline was something that kind of came and went. Sometimes I think I was more disciplined and more productive, and other times less so. But I think it's good to write when it's there. I think there is a value to pushing through, even if it's not there, to forcing yourself to do it, because I think it's a muscle that you need to exercise. There's a real value to making it happen, even if you're not feeling the inspiration. But at the same time, it's like it may not be quality writing if you're forcing it. So maybe that is a different type of exercise or something like that. So I think it was like I would work on it when the energy was in it at any given moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and allowing, I really like what you said, the idea that you need to allow for like spontaneous moments of inspiration, I think is really great. And I imagine, as somebody who also writes comedy, that like that's really important in that medium as well. Sort of on a related note, with a long-term project like this, obviously there are many like ups and downs just in life in general, but I imagine also with regard to, you know, like you were alluding to, the creative spark. And I'm wondering, like, were there certain things that you found helpful, that like little tricks or like hacks that you could turn to sort of rejuvenate and reset at times where it sort of felt like you had hit a wall?
I think that I would have to just kind of do my best to keep myself engaged in other art that I was finding inspiring. It didn't have to be directly necessarily prose or literature. Often it probably would be. I think there are, you know, there was some clear inspirations that I would be reading that would get me excited. But I think it was often just engaging with other art would get me excited to try to be creative on my own. I think if I'm listening to creatives on, you know, even if it's like I'm listening on podcasts or whatever, a lot of the times if I'm driving into work or driving home from work and I'm listening to some interview with any type of creative, a performer or a writer or a musician or anything, just hearing them talk about it, a lot of the times that gets me, you know, maybe it gets me jealous. When I hear other successful creatives talking about it, I'm like, okay, I need to be working on something. I got to be working on it too, because I think that kind of gets the engine going a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree. I think if I get stuck somewhere that I think like reading or like watching movies or like taking in other people's art is really inspiring, or even like, you know, work of my peers too, that'll like get me excited. And then also just kind of like, I think you can always kind of like, I think moving into like a place where it's like you're embracing your identity as writer. Like, I think I also took like workshops to like get feedback on some parts of this novel, and I do like, you know, like a regular like sort of, I mentioned that like mornings are kind of my time now, so I do like this thing called Morning Writing Club, and you don't get feedback there, but just kind of the fact that you're regularly logging in and doing that every morning, I think helps. So it's like, even if I'm not necessarily writing or working on the project directly, I'm still like mentally like putting myself in that space every day.
I also found that if you're snagged on a specific spot in whatever project you're working on, especially if it's a longer form thing, and if you've done a bit of planning and outlining, you can just be like, well, I'm not going to write about that part right now. I don't really know, like, I'm not interested in this spot. I'm just going to jump ahead to whatever happens next. And you don't have to, you know, obviously, like, you don't have to write anything in order. You don't have to work on anything in order. You work on it as you're interested in it. So that would be a big part. It's like, if I can tell that there's a hurdle, or just I'm hitting friction, or I'm just not excited by the next whatever's coming up next, I'll just skip it and I'll move on to the next part. And if I need to revisit the thing later, or maybe the reason it's not working for me is because the part I'm getting snagged on maybe needs to change in the plan or whatever it is, it's just like, just keep moving, you know, just it, like, you don't lose momentum because you're on a spot that isn't working for you right now. Just like, go somewhere else where the movement can keep happening.
Mm. Yeah, well said. I have a question about the editing process specifically. I imagine that it's sort of a combination of things, right? So like, if one is working with a publisher, you know, there's probably an editor that is assigned to work with you. Even if you're self-publishing, like, you would have somebody else read and give you feedback and likely edit the work. In your particular cases, do you think that the editing process, how do you think the editing process affected the end product of the novel compared to what it might have been otherwise?
I mean, I love editing. I think it's really fun. It's really like problem solving. It's when a book really comes together. And yeah, I think for me, like, I kind of, in terms of editing rounds, you know, I did, after I had like a first draft done, like going through like purely for content, right? And just like what scenes I wanted to drop, change storylines, and then kind of another pass that's kind of more about on like the sentence, like line level. So that kind of editing. And I mean, that sounds pretty tidy, but there are obviously like a lot of different things in between, but those are the main kind of edits that I'm doing. And then my publisher, Shabby Dollhouse, Lucy K. Shaw, the editor there, she read the manuscript a couple of times, and she accepted upon like not being like, well, we need to change the second half of the book. It wasn't major developmental edits, but she did have like some slight suggestions around certain things and scenes. And then also she was super helpful around like catching like copy editing type things and like typos as well.
Got it. What are the benefits, Kristen, to working with a publisher?
Well, I love my publisher. But I think in terms of a publisher, it's like, I mean, just like editorially, that was like a great benefit. But in the case of like Lucie and Shabby Dollhouse, it's like, you know, a one person press essentially. But just having someone else besides yourself that's a really, really great advocate for your book. I mean, just for morale, I think that's amazing. But then also, I mean, it can be so helpful once the book is actually published, from everyone, anything from like the process of making a book and having someone's ideas there and like a thought partner to once you go and promote the book, then your publisher is doing that with you. And like, you know, I have an ally in that as well.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, you self-published Lightning Bolt, right?
Or... I worked with a small publisher that basically just handled the logistics of actually like getting it out, getting it into the systems and stuff like that.
Right. Do you recommend the sort of route that you ended up taking, or?
That's a tricky thing to say. I'm happy with what we ended up with because I'm proud of the book as it stands, and I'm happy that it exists. I think. It certainly was not my initial plan going in. I would have loved to have had a little bit more of a partnership with a publisher and an editor. I wasn't able to have a lot of that with this one. And I'm certainly hopeful that on future projects, I am able to, you know, whether it's finding an agent or even just like a publisher who will have a little bit more of that kind of collaborative relationship. I think it's just a matter of you find whatever avenues are available. And you know, truth be told, I was right on the verge of giving up on this manuscript. I spent about a year, as I was coming into a close, finishing the final draft, I started looking around for all kinds. There's a big, vibrant world of independent publishers. There's so many presses. But since they're so small, since most of them are one or two people or whatever it is, they're only able to get through maybe a couple books a year, if that. Some of them might just be one a year. And so even though there's a number of great independent presses who are publishing really vibrant and exciting independent literature right now, it's still a very, very competitive space because each one of those can only handle so much. So I had been looking all around and just spent a year getting told no and had kind of put this last one out there. And I was chatting with another writer who was just kind of a internet acquaintance of mine. And I was like, what should I go back and see if there's something wrong with the book? I'm working on this next one. And his advice at that moment was, if you're working on a new thing, just keep working on that. And if you need to revisit this thing some other time, maybe you will, but maybe it just won't happen for that one. So that was the decision I made. And then a month or so after that, I found back from, so the publisher's called No Frills Buffalo. And, they're just kind of a small press that will sort of help local writers with whatever it is, you know, and they help kind of get it formatted and like I said, get it into, systems so that it can be available online or available for bookstores or whatever. So it was pretty bare bones in terms of the support I got. But I think that's you find your way forward and do what you can.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like right now the publishing industry is in like a very interesting, almost like chaotic spot. So whether you like are self-publishing, indie publishing, or like traditional publishing with like a larger publisher, the author is going to have to do like a lot of the work, from even just ideas about the book probably to promoting the book. But I think that's really exciting. And I think we're also like at a place where all those routes of publishing can like have like really like exciting places of success in the way that maybe they didn't like 10 years ago, 20 years ago.
Kristen, what you've said just sort of leads pretty well into my next question, which is, is it difficult to maintain your creative vision during the process of getting the book to print, or perhaps because there's more required of the writer beyond just the sort of, expected writing of the book? and requires more diligence on the writer's part, then perhaps it's not so hard to retain that vision. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, doing that stuff, even though I really enjoy it, like figuring out how a book comes together and how you promote it and like outreach for events for it, it is like its own job. So, I mean, in addition to having like a day job and like a social life, I can't also like write a second book at the same time. So I do think that like if you're doing that kind of like production and like promotion type stuff for books, unless you have like a situation where you have a lot of other free time, I think like the creative stuff kind of has to come like after, at least for me.
Got it. Cool. So we're going to take a quick break here on Connections. We've been talking about writing and publishing and promoting a novel with two of our own local writers, Kristen Felicetti and Charlie DeMott Wildy. We will be back to continue the conversation right after this brief break.
I'm Evan Dawson. Coming up in our next hour, a conversation about how to live with fewer plastics, especially single-use plastics. We're bringing back a conversation from July in which we talked about how you might try to go a month without using any new single-use plastics. It is not easy. Challenging for all of us, and you're going to get some ideas on how to do that a little bit better next hour.
And we're back on Connections. My name is Daniel Kushner, filling in for Evan Dawson. And I am here with Kristen Felicetti and Charlie DeMott Wildy, two local indie novelists who have each written really excellent books. Kristen is the author of Log Off, and Charlie is the author of Lightning Bolt. And I want to briefly, before we move forward, invite those who are listening to join us in the conversation. You can reach us at 585-263-9994 if you're in the Rochester area. If you're outside the Rochester area, you can connect with us at 844-295-8255, or you can email us at connections@wxxi.org. There is already someone who has emailed us to talk about the idea of maintaining a social media presence as a novelist. We will certainly get to that. And I thank you for that contribution to the show. I feel like I would be remiss during this hour if I didn't sort of give readers a little bit of a taste of each of your writing. So I'm going to read excerpts of each of your work, not exactly one after the other, but yeah. So we'll go from there. Let's start with. Really the very beginning of Kristen Felicetti's Log Off. Here we go. Tuesday, September 5th, 2000, 9:23 p.m. Hello, people of the internet. Let it be known that today, 95Y2K, my legal guardian Brian finally joined the modern world and connected our computer to the great World Wide Web. I told him I needed the internet for school, which was true, but my primary motivator was getting a live journal. No way I could start one at the library. Whenever I logged on, there was always some old lady librarian hovering around, waiting for the inevitable moment I surfed my way to a big old porn site or downloaded some malicious virus that would crash the entire public computer system. Kristen, what is it about LiveJournal that captured your imagination and continues to do so?
Thanks for doing that reading. I think like LiveJournal, it was one of the very, very early like blogging and like online platforms. So I don't know. I kind of think it kind of holds my imagination in like really formative years. But I think it was so. I'm not the only one that feels that way. I think it was so different than what the internet is now, right? Where it there was no like algorithm, you know, you kind of were just writing whatever you kind of felt like without worrying about whether it got a lot of likes or like a lot of comments. It was just like pure expressing yourself. And I don't know, I think there probably were problems then on LiveJournal too, but compared to like some social media platforms now, I think people were like a lot like kinder and empathetic and nicer too.
It's sort of before the levee broke kind of on social media culture as a whole.
Yes,
perhaps.
In comparison to the way like people act on like Twitter or something now. Yeah.
Right. Very cool. Yeah, I think that like I don't recall I never had a live journal, but I definitely remember people having live journals, and I it does feel like a simpler time. And it's sort of funny to be saying that as like in my old man perspective, you know, like referring to something that, you know, is part of the internet era and is like not that long ago in the scheme of things.
The internet's old now.
Yeah. But it is interesting. And the idea that your life online could be sort of compartmentalized, right? In that way, feels so foreign now. Everything is sort of integrated and connected to other apps, and it's just such a different way of existing in the world. But I think it's very indicative of how we're all, you know, millennials, right, from the same generation, and we sort of grew up in this sort of dual reality of we're old enough to remember like our parents kicking us out of the house and making us do something. And we're also young enough to like have had the internet and other technological advances that we just accept as everyday parts of life. And so that really is sort of captured so well within LiveJournal, within that context. So yeah, that's very cool. We'll shift gears. Without a better segue in mind, I'd like to read an excerpt from the first chapter of Charlie Demott Wilde's Lightning Bolt. If you don't mind. Okay.
Please.
All right. Overhead, above the rooftops, I'm going to start again. I didn't like that. Take two. All right. Overhead, above the rooftops, surveillance drones surveilled. Wyatt pulled the stool towards the window and leaned on the counter to see as much of the sky as he could. As he sat, the wind meandered around just right to reveal a glimpse of the blue of the sky, something that happened so rarely that it felt like a little treat. Scooting around, visible above the shog, where satellites hanging in the sky where you'd think they'd ought to fall right down. Most were dormant or dead, belonging to now defunct companies or governments, and they just kept drifting around and around until they bumped into something. Charlie, what is shog?
Well,
for those who are uninitiated,
I don't. It's one of the more science fiction-y. It's a relatively grounded science fiction world, for the most part. But that's one of the more kind of like I made up a word for something, and we're on public radio, so I don't know if I can say what it's a portmanteau of. But fog is the second part of it.
We can put it. And, we can put the rest together. I think.
Uh-huh. So it's basically if you know. In this world, there's been essentially a kind of complete environmental collapse, and pollution has just gone. So it's just the most exaggerated pollution. There's just a layer of garbage on everything, and so shog is just a part of that, where it's just there's this thick blanket of smoggy pollution just all over everything, to the point where, you know, the sky is basically never visible anymore.
Yeah, making the blue so much more spectacular. Yeah. I just found that setting so vivid and really articulate in sort of letting people know the world that they're entering into. And another thing that's cool about Lightning Bolt is it does have moments that are mundane, but peppered in are some really, you know, I'll say surreal is a good way to describe it. I hate that word because it's so overused, but very, the science fiction element is strong.
Yeah.
Let's say.
Yeah. There are, there's kind of a world that we are introduced to, and then, you know, it kind of gets upended in terms of like what our actual expectations of what could happen or appear in the world. But as far as the actual, like, the everyday of it, I did want it to feel mundane. I wanted to focus on the mundane elements because, like, all of the characters who exist in this world, they don't really understand that they live in a science fiction book. To them, they still have to pay rent. They take the bus. They have jobs, if they're lucky. And so I really wanted the actual world building to be pretty grounded, and so there are times when, and I actually kind of had to unlearn this. While I was writing this, I got so fixated on every little boring detail was in it because that was a feature. Because I wanted to be like, well, they live in a post-apocalypse, but it's like, okay, he finished his coffee. Where's he going to throw the coffee cup? Like, I wanted to focus on every like silly little detail because it's just like, well, they're just living in a, for them, it's just their life, you know? And then when I went on to write other things, it's like, oh, well, I don't need to be so fixated on boring details because that doesn't necessarily match other stuff I've gone on to write. So, yeah, I really wanted that kind of grounded sort of world building to build out from.
Yeah. I did want to get to the subject of representation insofar as it relates to the protagonists of each story. Charlie, I don't think I'm giving anything away. The Wyatt is gay, mm-hmm. and but he's also a person of color, right?
Yeah, he's half black and is I had him as kind of as bi in my head. The only like real romantic relationship that he has at any point during the book though is with another man. Yeah.
Right. And Kristen Allura Gao is an Asian teenage girl. How did in your writing process, I want to approach it from that angle. How did the identity of your characters make their way into the writing process? Is it something that just sort of happens organically where you know that based on the story you want to tell, it makes the most sense for the narrative for the character to have these facts about them? Or is it something that you go in from the onset knowing, okay, I want this character to identify in this way, to have this background, so on and so forth?
I feel like Laura's like Asian American, a teenage girl, and so am I, obviously. So that, like, you know, I think for me it was kind of like the opportunity. Like, it's such a like trope to have this like coming of age story where it's like kind of the sarcastic, angsty teen, and so like I felt like I kind of like I couldn't pass up the opportunity to have like that central figure be like a little bit different. And so like kind of like that kind of I think perspective, and like, you know, like same with like a lot of her friends, a lot of them are like either Asian or queer or something, but like it reflected like kind of my coming of age and my teenage years growing up here, but it felt pretty organic to me. Like I felt for me like I didn't want to make, like, even though it's there, like identity is there in those characters, it's definitely not like like a point that the story really turns around. Or, you know, I think when people have when they've read the book, they've been like delighted to like find that out, you know, even because it's not even like a big like marketing point in the book. But yeah, so pretty organic for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm a white, mostly straight writer. And so it isn't necessarily that I was, it was something that was a decision that I had to make. And it was really, I don't think it is a major part of who the character is. It just is a decision that I wanted to make because I didn't want, I feel like a lot of the times if, you know, race or orientation aren't pointed out, the assumption in a lot of American media is that, well, this character must be white, male, and straight. There's just kind of the, if you know, that's considered a default, and I didn't want that to be the default of the book. So as often as I could, any character is point, you know, when there are white characters, their whiteness is pointed out. And, you know, it's definitely something that I had to struggle with, you know, in terms of like, am I, is this something that maybe is not my decision to make or my place, like, to tell this story? It is certainly something that I thought a lot about, and I talked a lot about, and I talked to a lot of my friends who are, you know, either queer or are people of color, and I had a number of people read it before it was sent around anywhere to, you know, make sure that I was being fair with everything and being as accurate as I could. But really the point of it was just that it just is a part of who he is, but that doesn't have to, like, the book doesn't have to be about that part of it. It's just like any story can have any character in it. And I just kind of wanted to make a choice like, well, this could just be, another protagonist undefined. But I kind of made the decision early on that I wanted them to, just have a little bit of a different identity, because whiteness just did not have to continue to be the default in this story.
Yeah, that resonates with me. The idea that you do decide that having a character be this or that is a deliberate choice just because representation is important. Not because it's something, because it represents, because it, I think, because it better reflects a sort of a universal truth about existence and, like, reflects a wider swath of people, rather than sort of, you know, focus on it's not about focusing on a niche person or a niche identity, but rather including more people in the conversation.
And by and large, the other characters throughout the book are all essentially based on artistic communities that I've spent time in. So the diversity that's reflected in the book is really just what I would hope is an accurate representation of the various creative communities I've spent my time in. So it's mm-hmm. It really just came naturally from that.
I do want to turn to the internet. Alex writes in, how important is it for a writer to have a large social media presence? Obviously, it's a good thing to have for going through traditional channels, helps the book to be marketed by the publisher, and for self-publishing, it makes sense to already have a potential audience of sorts. And while there's certainly an ability for niche communities on Reddit and Facebook to discover self-published authors, does that actually happen? What are your thoughts?
It is really important. It's not something I'm very good at, and I don't know that it's something, you know, that I necessarily have found an abundance of success in. I think that the website formerly known as Twitter was a really vibrant place for the writing community and independent writers, and it does still kind of seem to be where there's a lot of discussion happening. I think this is a pretty big conversation where broadly I think our relationship with social media is changing, and I don't know where it's going to end up, but I think that by and large a lot of us are spending less time on social media, and or at least those like post-a-thon style social media apps, and I don't know what the next thing will be or how that will impact writing moving forward.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, I don't think it's necessarily important to have, like, a large following. You definitely don't need that to, like, get a book deal or publish your book, except for maybe, like, nonfiction books. But I think it is important to have them, right? Like, I don't have a really large following on Instagram or Twitter or my Substack or anything. But, like, that was, like, really crucial as, like, a channel to have, like, when I wanted to, like, announced that the book was out and, like, tell people to buy it and, like, also, to promote this book. Like, I did a tour with another author on Shabby Dollhouse, Oscar D'Artois, this author of a poetry book called The Island. And so he and I and Lucy, the publisher, we went on tour. And so every single tour stop, we also were able to promote the events and, like, let people know about that. So having that channel to sort of promote, like, the tour, to promote, even just to do, like, kind of call to actions, be like, hey, my book is out. Does anybody, like, want to do an interview with me? And, like, that helped, you know? So I think having those for those reasons to promote your work definitely helped. But it doesn't have to be, like, a large following. And, yeah, I don't know, though. Like, it does seem to be getting more and more fractured, so I'm not sure whether that statement will be true in 5 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of promotion, where can our listeners find each of you and your work online?
If you search my name, you should hopefully be able to find me on most major places. I also have a Substack called Feed Charlie, so you can find me there, and hopefully things are all linked. I am still on Twitter. I don't post much there, but...
Yeah, I have a website, you know, kristenfelicetti.com, and like links to all my like socials are there. And yeah, and then, and also links to buy the book.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. One last question, it's for both of you, and that is, for people who are thinking about writing a book, writing a novel, what is the big piece of advice that you would give?
I would say, this advice is for people that probably have like limitations on their time to kind of get it done, which is almost everybody, is like, I think like two things, like really kind of like what we talked about earlier is like make sure that you like carve out time for writing. Otherwise you can really get like lose track. So whatever time that might be for you, find that time and make it consistent. And then also like writing a novel is like kind of a long project. And sometimes you're like, oh, do I even want to do this? Like, is anything ever going to come to this? So I would say that like put yourself in like spaces where like that part of writing can be affirmed for you, like online or in person.
Charlie, you've got about 10 seconds.
I agree. Write something you're excited about and it'll get done.
Very cool. Thank you to both of my guests, Kristen Felicetti and Charlie DeMott-Wildy. This has been Connections. I'm Daniel Kushner. Thanks so much for listening.